Will the results in the New Hampshire primary tomorrow influence your vote? On Insight, David Siders checks in from New Hampshire. He's on the campaign trail with the presidential candidates. He says tomorrow's primary might not resolve the discord in the Democratic Party. This is Black History Month across the country. Ginger Rutland has been reexamining the history of Oak Park and the history of her own family. Her play, When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, based on her mother Eva's book, opens Friday at the Guild Theater in Oak Park. Did you watch or listen to the Oscars last night? The top 25 nominees were given the traditional luxurious gift bag, a swag bag it's called, but this year, a novel by Elk Grove author Katie Storm was in the bag. So later this hour, we'll meet KD and hear the story. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's all coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Pete Buttigieg, as you are hearing in the newscast, will be in Sacramento Friday. Bernie Sanders is starting a three-day tour of California colleges Monday. Vice President Mike Pence, again, it has been noteworthy that he will campaign for President Trump in Reno next week. You can certainly tell that the presidential race will be moving west. But first of all, there's New Hampshire tomorrow. David Siders is in New Hampshire joining us by cell phone. Hello, David.
Hi, good to be here.
So I guess you're in the midst of snow. Where exactly are you and what's happening around you?
See, we're driving from Keene to Nashua, where Amy Klobuchar is having some events today. She's one of the, I think, the candidates that people are watching because she's a candidate who could make a move. If she finished well, I think tomorrow she could cement herself as a legitimate contender in this race. And I think if she doesn't, signs will point the other way.
So, David, you're Politico's national political correspondent. A lot of folks here in Sacramento know you from your senior writer role at the Sacramento Bee. But you filed a story today saying that there is a realization setting in that nothing that happens in New Hampshire is really going to resolve what's underlying in the Democratic Party. Would you expand on that?
Yeah, I think what's going on here is that most years you have some culling of a large primary field in Iowa and New Hampshire, but clearly that didn't happen in Iowa, and I don't think there's any reason to expect it will happen tomorrow in New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden will still go on, even if Biden has a very poor day. He still has South Carolina and Nevada to look ahead to, where he has stronger support with people of color. Pete Buttigieg is almost the inverse case, where he's doing well in Iowa and New Hampshire, but has no demonstrated support with people of color. And then you have, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Michael Bloomberg's waiting in the wings. So I think this looks like a race that stands to be muddled at least through Super Tuesday.
I'm going to jump ahead here a moment to Tom Steyer because of what you just said, who apparently is polling strong in South Carolina, which is another interesting factor. To refer back to your article, some people said to you, this race is just all over the map, or mumbo jumbo, as one person said.
Yeah, Steyer's an interesting case. I think how he's polling in South Carolina is a huge surprise. And it could be one of two things. It could be that he's strong there, and we'll see when Biden shows up and Buttigieg, if he's still doing well after Nevada. The other possibility is that Steyer has invested a lot of money in South Carolina and time, and so he's almost had the landscape to himself. It's unclear how he'll do there, in part for the same reason it's unclear how Joe Biden will do there. I guess the question is, how much of a momentum state is South Carolina, and how much of it is baked in? So here in New Hampshire and then in Nevada greatly influence South Carolina, or are they people whose loyalties stay, and then that obviously advantages somebody like Biden and I suppose somebody like Steyer.
So you're alluding to one of the questions that I ask, which is California voters who have until March 3rd to cast their ballot have their ballot on their kitchen counter or in their car, whatever, the mail-in ballot. How much do you think voters wait to see how the field narrows, where the momentum is, before casting that ballot?
It's a good question. I would imagine that Paul Mitchell or somebody there would have some good historical analysis of that. My guess is that more people will wait this time because they will, you know, understand that the field is so unsettled. I certainly wouldn't turn out a ballot today if I was voting in California. I'd be waiting to see what South Carolina looks like.
So the Iowa results are in. 14 delegates went to Pete Buttigieg, 12 to Bernie Sanders. Then the field went Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, one delegate to Amy Klobuchar. Are you hearing that Bernie Sanders is challenging those results? What's the news on the ground there?
That's right. Last night, his campaign manager said they would be calling for a partial re-canvass of those ballots. And, you know, I believe at least as of 30 minutes ago, the race was still too close for the Associated Press to call. That's just a mess that has really clouded over the entire week here, I think, in this primary.
How so? How do you know, or who's saying what about Iowa's impact there?
Well, I think that what happened in Iowa, first of all, created some tension between the candidates that might not otherwise have been there. You talk to Bernie Sanders supporters who believe that Buttigieg, by claiming victory early, essentially, you know, stole momentum that he might not otherwise have had in New Hampshire. And we do see him with some momentum here. On the other hand, Buttigieg, regardless of how he finished, did well in Iowa. And so maybe it does, you know, it can rightfully come by some of that momentum. But that's created some tension. When the state party chairman sits down to meet with reporters, the second or third question he's asked is, what are your recount procedures? And, you know, how many days should we extend hotel reservations beyond Election Day? So I think it's just created an air of tension that persists.
And a joke in the Oscar show last night, too, about counting the ballots for the winning Academy Awards. So it's now moved into popular culture. 33 delegates are at stake in New Hampshire, and the town of Dixville Notch is going to vote first. Do you know some of the backstory there?
Yes, this is a town that, weren't they at risk this year of not having enough residents?
Yeah, they only had four. They need five to vote, and so somebody that was just living just outside the city border moved in time to vote in the primary.
That's so interesting. Look, you know, the experience in Iowa, right? Everybody has these quaint experiences of a caucus, and I know New Hampshire is different, but there are quirks here, just like the Dixville Notch thing that you talk about. I do wonder how long that can be sustained. There is, you know, it's an enjoyable process, I think, for people to watch, and there's something likable and traditional about it. On the other hand, there is a whole swath of America that looks at these two heavily white states with very, you know, in Iowa's case anyway, this obscure kind of difficult to understand caucus system and say, what in the heck are we doing starting our presidential elections there? It comes up every 4 years, I guess, but I think after this it will be reexamined again.
I'm talking with Politico's national political correspondent, David Siders. He's joining us by cell phone from a snowy area of New Hampshire. On the road he is. If you're a California voter waiting to see what New Hampshire does, or a Nevada caucuser for that matter, you're going to have an answer tomorrow night, and NPR will have coverage of the night, which CAP Radio will carry live. Let's back up to Friday night and the New Hampshire debate. And I want you to hone in particular on Tom Steyer's debate performance. He's getting some interesting attention for a couple reasons.
Yeah, the exchange. Well, first of all, he didn't stare directly at camera. He actually debated like a normal human being, which I think was roundly well received. He was at a Bloomberg News forum yesterday, and I asked him if, you know, there was an advisor who had told him to do that, and he said, no, I just forgot. And so he's planning to go back to the straight-to-camera debating that he says speaks more like he's speaking to the American people. But I guess beyond the style, the substantive point with Tom was his challenge of Joe Biden to disavow remarks that a prominent South Carolina surrogate of his, Dick Harpootlian, made recently about a supporter of Tom's. And Tom Steyer said that the remarks were racist. Dick Harpootlian has said that they weren't. There was a squabble on stage. I don't think it's consequential to the campaign unless Steyer puts money behind advertising in South Carolina on Biden and race. And if he does that, I think that could have some effect. Steyer certainly has the money to if he chooses to.
There's also conversation about Tom Steyer trying to buddy up to Bernie Sanders. Twitter took off about it. It seemed noticeable and unusual to people. It's caused a lot of conversation about kissing up to the billionaires in this Monday after the weekend. What's the talk there around that? I'm sure you know or have followed some of the social media on this.
Yeah, I think Steyer is genuinely a happy warrior and happy to be friendly with anybody on that stage. And ideologically, he rejects the idea of being cast as, where you would normally put a businessman, which would be in the moderate lane. He sees himself as a progressive with an understanding of the economy, which I think is a tough place to be, but that's certainly... I think that that explains where he sees himself there. I don't think he would be buddying up ideologically anyway any more to a Joe Biden than a Bernie Sanders. Think about climate change and some of the policies he would support. I mean, heck, backing reparations, that's a pretty progressive place to be. So I think that's where that stems from.
Is this the first time you've been on the presidential campaign trail, David?
It certainly is like this. I'd worked there in Sacramento, and we'd see candidates come through and occasionally go to Reno, but I haven't been like this before.
So just in general, your impressions from Iowa and now to New Hampshire, and then you'll cross the country to Nevada for a debate on the 19th in Las Vegas, and then the Nevada caucuses on the 22nd. How is it?
Oh, personally, it's fine. It's a good thing to be doing. I think for the candidates, it's unusual because there are so many of them, and it's still just so uncertain. And I think that when you contrast that with what's going on with the president recently, he's had a pretty good week. I think Democrats are a little bit apprehensive about the next few months here, and so some of the things you'd normally see in Iowa or New Hampshire, really excited mood around like Dixville Notch or the tables at the steakhouse in Iowa maybe would be a little more celebratory. I think there is at least an air of worry tucked in there.
So you quoted Amanda Renteria, who was the national political director of Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016, and she said, "This week didn't feel good. There's no doubt about that. It didn't feel good from an our party standpoint." So some candidates are not there. Mike Bloomberg is about to fully engage in the process in a different way. What are the logistics here? Some will stay through tomorrow night, I imagine, but tell me about the movement of everybody.
Yeah, I think many candidates will immediately go to Nevada and California. There's a nexus there where you can do fundraising in California and campaign in Nevada at the same time. That's helpful to some of these candidates who need money. Bloomberg is still focused entirely on Super Tuesday, so you just see him bombarding the airwaves going forward. I think that's the logistics.
All right, David. Sounds like you're walking in crunchy snow, at least to my Minnesota ears. So,
well, at least the reporters around me are. We've made it to the destination.
All right. Thanks so much for the time in between. Appreciated checking
Thank
in with you,
you
on
so
the
much.
Road. All right. That is David Siders, Politico's national political correspondent. We'll post a link to his latest article, which he posted today. And NPR will have special coverage of the New Hampshire primary tomorrow night. You can hear it on CAP Radio starting at 6 p.m. Pacific time. Up next, Oak Park over the decades. Ginger Rutland is staging her play When We Were Colored at the Guild Theater in Oak Park, and she reflects on her family's history there. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A play by Sacramento journalist Ginger Rutland titled When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story, is based on a memoir by Ginger's late mother, Eva. She was a successful and prolific romance novelist. Eva kept writing almost to the end of her long life of 95 years. Ginger republished her mom's memoir in 2007. The two hit the trail on a book tour, in fact. And then Ginger adapted it for theater after her mom's death in 2012. She has staged it most recently in 2019 at Sacramento Theater Company, and now she's bringing it to the Guild Theater in the heart of the community that her mother wrote about. Ginger, hello.
Hello, Beth. Thank you.
Every time we talk about this play, it seems that the conversation is new again.
Yes. Yes. I'm bringing it back, and I'm bringing it to Oak Park. You have to understand that when my family came to Sacramento in 1952, Oak Park was one of the few neighborhoods where Black people could actually buy homes. That's where we shopped. That's where we went to church. That's where we socialized. I have very fond memories of Oak Park in the 50s. It was a vibrant community then.
So bringing this play to Oak Park is a homecoming.
It is a homecoming. I loved the experience at the Sacramento Theater Company in the Wells Fargo Pavilion. It was enormously successful, more than 60 performances, all of them sold out. And that was one of the problems. A number of people were unable to get tickets. Many people were unable to get tickets because it sold out. So I decided I wanted to restage it. And where better than in Oak Park? Because that's where much of what I write about happens.
Your mother was such a colorful character, you know, just in her personality, in her style, in her speaking, in her wisdom. And the play was a series of vignettes about topics that were really true to life. But what else was it? What was so captivating and so universal about the play?
My mother was writing as a mother. Her target were, frankly, white mothers. And she wanted to tell them that her children, she had come out of the segregated South. She was coming into an integrated environment for the first time in her life. And she wrote stories with the idea of letting her audience, whom she thought of as white mothers, she wanted to tell them that her children were just as precious and just as fragile as theirs. Please be kind. That was her message.
I'd like to talk more about Oak Park, but I think it's a good moment to bring in our other guest here in the studio, who has been very quiet. Chelsea, glad to have you here.
Hi.
So Chelsea Rutland is a family member, but also the actress who has quite a role to take on. Chelsea, you're going to step onto the stage as your grandmother, Eva
yes.
Rutland.
Yes.
When Ginger first approached you with this idea, what was your all of the picture of your grandmother and your willingness or ability to take that on?
I think I was hesitant at first. But since we've began this process, it's become, I don't know what the correct word for it is. It's become extremely special, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I saw the other productions, and I thought all of the other actresses brought something amazing and something unique, and actually opened my eyes to parts of my grandmother that I may have been blind to, so to speak, at first. So to see her through someone else's eyes was really nice. And now I get to bring my own piece to that. And
you just used air quotes around the word blind.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's a detail we haven't talked about.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So go ahead.
My grandmother was blind. Actually, my grandmother never saw me, so she was blind my whole life. But it didn't feel that way. I felt that she always saw me, so it wasn't something I ever thought about very much. But yes, she was blind, and she did write books, and it is tremendously special.
Chelsea, you didn't know Oak Park growing up, did you?
I did know Oak Park. I didn't spend a lot of... I grew up in Curtis Park, so I did know Oak Park. It's right down the road. But no, it is... I've never... It's definitely transformed. I never went to the Guild. It was a movie theater before. So, yeah, I have not spent a lot of time there.
And except your brother went to...
Oh, Christian Brothers. Yes, my brother went to Christian Brothers. So, yeah.
that phrase, knowing Oak Park, I think you'd get a different definition in a different decade.
Yes. I came to this city in 1952, and Oak Park was... an integrated middle-class, working-class neighborhood,
and had been for
and
a few
had
decades.
Been for had been forever. It was Sacramento's first suburb, and it was connected to all other parts of Sacramento. What happened in the 60s? They built the freeways. They built 99. They built 99, and they built 50, and it cut Oak Park off from its more affluent and whiter neighbors. So Curtis Park now is separated from Oak Park by the 99 freeway. And East Sacramento is separated from Oak Park by the 50 freeway. And so it sort of closed itself off. And other things happened. They redeveloped what is now called Old Sacramento. It was called the West End. And that's where people of color lived in this town. Asians, Japanese, Chinese, Hispanics, and blacks lived in the West End. And they decided, well, it's a blighted area. We're going to clean it out. And they did. And all of those people then had to be relocated. And there were very few places where legally you could live as a person of color in this town because of the racial covenants that were on the deeds. So people of color crowded into Oak Park, or they went to Del Paso Heights.
And it rolled. You know, the Oak Park area went into kind of an orphan status.
It went into a serious decline. And it was amazing to me because I left Sacramento in 1965. I went off. We lived in Europe for a little while, and I went to college. And I came back, and the Oak Park that I knew was gone. The 35th Street, which was full of shops and life and commercial, it was the commercial corridor that was really important, was all boarded up, and it had become blighted. Much of Oak Park had become blighted. There was redlining. People couldn't get loans to improve their homes there. It was kind of a neglected area. It was a mess. What I love about doing my play at the Guild in Oak Park is there's a renaissance going on there. It is beautiful. There are restaurants, and there's a garden shop, and there's a bakery, and all of this new brewery. It's a fun place to be again.
A drive through there just this weekend, in fact, showed how many people are out and about on the streets. Mm-hmm. The Sacramento Food Bank area is thriving with new construction and new places for its services. There are renovated Victorians, renovated homes. And for some people, this is plus, like you're saying, a wonderful transition for the area. For some people, it will again mean moving out, moving on.
Yeah, it's a complicated situation, but it's not unique to Oak Park. The rents have increased. They've tripled and quadrupled. And so people who have been there are being priced out. And that is a problem not just in Oak Park, but in Land Park, in Curtis Park, in Fair Oaks, in throughout Sacramento, and Chelsea's from Los Angeles, also in Los Angeles. It's the cost of housing is prohibitive, and the homelessness is increasing because of it. Oak Park is suffering from this, but so are other parts of this city.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that also to rejuvenate a community, which every community, frankly, deserves, other people have to be displaced in the process. I think that's something interesting. And I think there's a better way of solving that. I'm not quite sure what that means. It is interesting, though, that every time a community gets renewed and things are brought back, that original community needs to be displaced. So that is a larger conversation that definitely needs to be had.
What was your post-high school? You went to high school here in the Sacramento area. Mm-hmm. And then what was the journey between here and L.A.? And is this a homecoming in a sense for you, too, to come back and do the play?
Yes, it's a tremendous homecoming. It is a tremendous homecoming, and I'm a happy homecoming. I get to, my grandparents were a huge part of my life, and I get, sorry, I've been quiet because I knew I was going to get emotional, and I get to revisit them and make them a huge part of my life again.
This show opens Friday.
Yes.
Are you ready for the expectations and the connection that people have with your grandmother, with Eva?
Yes. I saw it in the last play.
You saw that response,
yes,
that interaction?
Yes, I saw the response in the last play, and I was so shocked. Again, I got to see it through other people's eyes, and it's something I took for granted because I just grew up with it, and it's all I knew. But it really, a lot of other people approached me and started talking about their grandparents and their parents and where they were from. And, oh, they came from Ohio, too. Or they, they experienced similar things as well. And that was really, really special and amazing. And it was good to know that Ginger's story that, she and my grandmother's story helped other people feel comfortable with their stories and validated other people's stories as well. So
that's Chelsea Carball Rutland. She will be Eva Rutland in the play that opens February 14th. When We Were Colored will be at the Guild Theater in Oak Park through March 14th. It is an adaptation of the book by Eva Rutland, the adaptation by her daughter Ginger Rutland. And Ginger has a long career as a journalist, including years at the Sacramento Bee, years here at Cap Radio as well. So in staging this, this comes at a time when there has been such a concerted effort from so many arenas to lift up the dialogue, mm-hmm. to kind of flush out the humanity of people, the stories, the understanding. And in the end, I guess this play becomes a part of it. What are you hoping comes out of this?
What my mother did, and is she, when you talk about race, it's so fraught. People feel muffled. People feel attacked. And I think what my mother has given people in her book is a way to look at people as people, that the black people that she's talking about, her own family, we're just like everybody else. We raise our children, we go to work, we pay our taxes, and we try to get along. And I think my mother provides a safe place for people to talk about race, which is, you know, a subject that is often very emotional and makes people angry. But my mother was not angry. She lived a very joyful life. And so much of black theater is grim. It's about bad things that have happened to black people. And her life was not grim. My life has not been grim. I don't think Chelsea's life has been grim. Was it grim, Chelsea?
No. But I did always ask them for the, what was it like back then, you know, and their response was, great. I had a beautiful life. Yeah.
What about your contemporaries, Chelsea, in your friend group? How are those conversations about race and division, even gentrification?
I think I'm lucky with my friend group. So they're always heated conversations, but we always come to the same sort of...
And what heats up a conversation right now?
What heats up race, our president, who we're, which Democratic, the Democratic primaries, because we all are, you know, divided on who would be the best person to replace the person we currently have in office. And that's something, probably the Democratic primaries right now.
So when you go back to the language of this play and things your grandmother said in the 50s and into the 60s, what's the connection point for you? What part of that is contemporary in the questions and issues you wrestle with in your own life?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably I'm all of it. I mean, you haven't seen the play, but there.
I saw the Sacramento Theater Company version, and some of the funny instances are of the time, you know, the clothes or the hair or
yes,
things like that.
And there's a particular scene that is with Ginger, the character that plays Ginger, Eva's daughter, and they're arguing about the civil rights movement, and Ginger's out protesting, and they just have different ways of solving the same issue, which is an argument I constantly have with my parents. I am an avid supporter of Bernie Sanders. And
you've said it
now. Yes, I've said it. It's out there. I tried not to, but I couldn't really. And they love Bernie Sanders, but they also believe that there are better options out there. And it's a similar argument we have, because I feel that there needs to be radical change and radical uprooting, and they believe there is a more... I'm using gestures. You guys can't see me right now. I'm very hand and gesture oriented.
Yeah. She's moving her hands broadly on the horizon.
They believe there is a lesser, more extreme way of
You're
doing
a college
things.
Graduate. Can I ask if you're in the 20-something category or the 30-something category?
I am in the 20-something, okay. Late 20-somethings.
Okay.
28.
Right.
Yes.
But she's interesting. That's very interesting to me, because there is a scene in the play in which I'm arguing with my parents about black power and the need to, you know, call yourself black. You can't call yourself colored anymore. And I have this huge afro that's so big you can almost not get through a door. And Chelsea it's interesting to me that Chelsea is having these same conversations with her parents about the various candidates and whether to have the radical one or the more conservative one or
yeah.
whatever.
I mean, it's this. It comes back and it comes back and it comes back.
Yeah, and it's a big discussion everyone is having right now.
Yeah.
So
what do you want people to take from this play and the fact that it's in the heart of Oak Park and the family history is true history there?
I guess that everyone's story deserves to be told. And no matter how, this is what I'm getting from it, at least, no matter how small or insignificant it might seem it to you, if you tell it, people will want to listen and be open to listening, and you will encourage someone else to tell their story. I think it's, yeah, your stories.
I see some of your mom in her. I do, Ginger.
I see a lot of my mother in her. The resemblance between my mother at 28 and Chelsea at 28 is rather remarkable. Mm. You see these two pictures together, which is something I had never done.
Seen that, Chelsea?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. It's remarkable, the resemblance between the two. And because photographs, old family photographs, are such a big part of the play, Chelsea matches the photograph of my mother as a young woman.
Hmm. Yeah. I never thought I really looked like her, but I do feel we have similar mannerisms and a similar soul and a similar way of communicating. But yeah, I never thought I looked like her, but I guess I do.
So this is Black History Month, and I don't know if that's why you staged the play this month, but why is that designation important? Why does Oak Park continue to be important to the Black community?
You know, it just happened that the Guild Theater was available this month, and it coincided with Black History Month, which is a good marketing tool, I guess. But it could have been in any month at any time. Black history, white history, history goes on no matter what month it is or what night it is. The Oak Park connection, though, is really important. If you know anything about theater in this town, professional theater, it is overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly rather elderly. I was very interested in trying to bring a more diverse audience to my play because because it's about them. It's about us. It's about a segment of Black America that you don't often see on television or something. This huge swath of middle-class Black folks that don't make the evening news. And that's who my parents were and who I am, and I think who Chelsea is. And I wanted to tell their story, and I wanted so many in Sacramento who've lived that life to come see the story. And so I tried to do it in Oak Park, where they came from and I came from.
Yeah, it was very kismet.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's luck. Yeah, kismet is a good way to describe it.
All right. Well, the previews open on Friday, February 14th. There's the official big opening on the 16th. The play runs through March 14th. We will post a link with ticket information, the cast, some pictures. Chelsea Rutland, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck.
Thank you.
In this homecoming debut in this family play. And Ginger, congratulations again. I know this has been a personal passion project that you have really been the driving force and spirit of. So good luck with this run.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you very much.
Journalist and playwright Ginger Rutland. Again, the play is When We Were Colored. That link is at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. So this is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sacramento's award-winning writer-director Greta Gerwig celebrated an Academy Award for Little Women. Jacqueline Duran won Best Costume. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks, also has some Sacramento roots, as many of you know, was celebrated in the opening production. I have to let our technical team know that there is a very loud buzzing happening in the studio that maybe somebody can help out with before we go on. But I'll continue to say that the top 25 nominees at last night's Oscars received a fabulous gift bag, and this is part of the Oscar tradition. It doesn't have to do specifically with the Oscars, but it is something that gets a lot of attention, a lot of publicity, and a lot of fun for everybody. This year's bag was estimated by Forbes magazine to be more than $225,000. In that bag, a novel written by Katie Storm of Elk Grove titled Carson's Garage was there for all the nominees, and Katie's with me in the studio to fill us in. Hi, I think I owe you some congratulations for all of this.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
So this is the morning after your Oscar night. Tell me how you are.
I'm very excited. I'm excited because there are so many Hollywood notables that now have a copy of Carson's Garage awaiting for them in their homes.
Among the other fabulous gifts were a 12-day trip for two on a yacht, dinner at Flora's Field Kitchen, a private call with a life coach, all kinds of things. When and how does the story begin that your book ended up in this bag?
So I took a writing class with Jerry Roberts, and he is someone who helped to promote the DVD, The Secret.
From the book, The Secret.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And he was able to get a copy of the DVD into the swag bags at one of the Oscars. The morning after, the celebrities were being interviewed about the Oscars, but they kept referring back to the DVD. They kept talking about The Secret. They were so fascinated by it. And in short, Oprah picked up on the DVD, and when Oprah touches something, we know what happens
right.
from there.
It became gold.
Exactly. And so taking this class with Jerry, I decided to try that route myself. So I went online, and I found the company that handles putting these swag bags together, contacted them, paid them a lot of money, and now Hollywood has Carson's Garage.
That's an important point here, is that you actually pay to have your book included.
Yes.
Or your item.
Yes, exactly. It's they do have a process of reviewing your item, so it's not just about paying. Your item, whatever it is, your service, has to be approved by the company. But at the end of the day, you're paying them.
So tell me about that conversation. How did that go with them speaking with you about Carson's Garage? And I know we haven't said anything about the actual book yet, but what was that sort of vetting process?
Thankfully, I suppose there wasn't a whole lot. He wanted to, Lash is his name, Lash Ferry, he wanted to see a copy of the book, so I got him a copy of the book. He reviewed it. I don't know exactly what they were looking for, but after reviewing it, sent me an email, and he responds to emails really quickly saying that he wants to help support me and bring the book into the swag bag, and actually offered me a discount. That's what I'm hoping.
And you needed to provide 26 copies?
26 copies in total, 25 to the Oscar nominees, and one went to the host.
All right, so backing up, you did this in lieu of pursuing traditional publishing routes for your book, correct? You'd written a novel and decided to start out in other ways.
Right.
Because?
I want to see how far I can push Carson's Garage on my own. Before going the traditional publishing route. Unfortunately, with traditional publishing, upwards of 97% of the profits and the rights go to the company that decides to pick up your book. And I wanted to see if I can earn some kind of success with Carson's Garage doing it on myself through self-publishing. But I've also given myself a timeline. So sometime around this summer, June, July-ish, is when I have given myself a deadline to see how far Carson's Garage has gotten. And if I need to at that point, then I'm going to look into traditional publishing.
I don't have figures to refute your 97% figure. I can say that I know it can be 1 to 2 to 3 years or more to go through the pipeline for a publisher. And you're a bit on a life fast track right now. You have already checked some of those major boxes of success. You graduated high school, you went to college, you're married, and you were in a career. So the shift to writing has been, is it correct to say it's been a leap of faith for you?
Writing has been a passion ever since I can remember, and it's a hobby for me, just as much as working out, keeping in shape is. So I find time every day to give at least a half an hour to an hour to writing. And being able to commit to a consistent schedule like that has allowed me to take writing into the path that it's in right now. So I didn't have to give up a lot of things or a lot of time or sacrifice something else to pursue writing. It's something that I'm doing jointly with everything else in life.
I'm talking with Katie Storm. He is the author of Carson's Garage. Is that your pen name? Is that your real name?
It's my pen name. Katie is my initials, actually.
Okay. Yep. Do you want to reveal the real name?
You want to know? Khaled Dastagirzada.
Okay. And Carson's Garage was in the swag bag. I want to talk about the book itself. The cover is a boy holding on to a huge German Shepherd. And the boy is just wrapped around the German Shepherd's neck. So right away, you know it's a dog story. Carson's Garage doesn't tell you much about it. But this dog is really the central character in the book, Sparky. Where does the dog come from? In a dream, an imagination of yours?
You know, I don't remember where I got the idea of this oversized dog. One of the things that I do with my writing, and it kind of mimics Stephen King, is I put pen to paper and I let things flow. I have a general outline for the book on how I want things to go. But as I'm writing, I don't let that outline deter from what's being written down at that moment. So the reason why I picked the German Shepherd was because, from what I understand, a German Shepherd is probably the most loyal of dogs. And so that's why I had the dog Sparky be a German Shepherd. But his size, things like that, it just came as I was writing.
So like Stephen King, you do write in the horror genre. And now suddenly everybody is thinking, wait, what? That is not the path I was going down with this. The boy, Tommy, who is the beloved friend of Sparky and actually rescues him, has a struggle in his own life. He's a little developmentally slow. His family life has been tough. And this dog absolutely delivers in that relationship. The surprise of this dog is that there are crimes that happen down the road, and this dog is involved in a very interesting way. And you need to walk us, KD, into believing that this dog could be part of what happens. And I think that that's one of the accomplishments of this book. It's a real surprise.
Thank you. Let's just say that that people start to disappear after a while in this book. And there is a dark force that overtakes this beloved and gentle dog. And it's a force that Sparky wants nothing to do with, but he's overpowered by it. And it does lead him and Tommy, the best friends, down this path of running from the police, hiding, doing whatever it is that they can to stay together. That's their ultimate goal, is that they need to stay together to survive.
Have you had any feedback yet this morning from anyone that received your book?
No, I haven't had any feedback yet. I think half of them are still probably waking up from last night.
There are lists all over. We'll link one of everything that's in this swag bag. And right there it is, Carson's Garage by Katie Storm. What would your wildest dream about all of this be? You know, Greta Gerwig from Sacramento is going to get your book and see that it's an author from Elk Grove. I wonder if those dots will connect.
That would be a dream come true if we can meet up and connect on this or something else, another one of my writings. But my wildest dream, my ultimate goal at the end of this is to have Carson's Garage turned into a blockbuster hit on the big screen. If that happens, then I'm satisfied.
Well, I guess once you've gotten your book into the swag bag, the sky's the limit on what else could happen. In the back of this book, you give readers the options for what book you're going to pursue or release next. You have a couple choices. Has the choice been made yet?
The choice has been made, but one of the things that I've noticed is I've given readers and fans the option to reach out to me and let me know where they want me to go, because I want to see where the interest is. Mm. And so the books that I have mentioned in the back of Carson's Garage are all books that I'm willing to take on next. And so after fans reach out to tell me that hopefully they loved Carson's Garage, which everyone who's reached out to me has said that, I'd like to hear what they would like for me to write. And then from there, I may or may not embark on that path.
And for now, you're still keeping the day job, right?
Yes, but a part of that dream would be to go into retirement from the day job and focus on writing full time, that's for sure.
All right, that is K.D. Storm. His novel is Carson's Garage, which is available at Amazon.com if you weren't lucky enough to get it at the Oscars last night. We've posted a link to his website and more information about the book on our website. And K.D., one more thought.
I'd just like to say that this Friday from 4 to 7 p.m., there's going to be a book signing for of Carson's Garage in Angel's Hair Salon, located at 1229 J Street, right across from the Sheraton.
Great. We'll post that information. That's this Friday. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for reaching out to us with the story, and keep us posted on this growing writing career.
I definitely will. Thank you for having me.
That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. On tomorrow's show, Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Paul Kitagaki Jr. He'll talk about his book, Behind Barbed Wire. And then Christian Kiefer joins us to talk about his latest novel, Phantoms. There is a connection. Join us and find out. And thanks for joining us today.